Welcome to episode 17 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe and Johnson. Thank you for joining us. We are lawyers talking about technology, security, privacy, and government. And I'm joined today by a large cast of characters, two guests, and two partners who have been occasional participants in past podcasts as well as our regulars. So Stephen Heifetz, former Deputy Assistant Secretary and Acting Assistant Secretary for the Office of Policy Development at DHS, where he shaped the department's role in CFIUS, now a partner at Steptoe & Johnson. Stephanie Roy, a partner in Steptoe's Telecom Internet and Media Practice. Michael Vadas, a regular, formerly with the FBI and Justice Department, now a partner in Steptoe's New York office. And Jason Weinstein, formerly with the Justice Department, where he oversaw criminal and computer crime prosecutions, among other things, and is now doing criminal and civil litigation at Steptoe. I'll introduce our guests when they have mics so that they can respond. I am Stuart Baker, formerly with the NSA and DHS, and record holder for returning to Steptoe & Johnson to practice law more times than any other lawyer. Let's get started. This week in NSA, you know, what's newsworthy this week in NSA is there's practically no news, and none of it was made by people who hate NSA, or very little of it. There are a few bits and pieces, and one last-minute Friday document dump that probably produced the most interesting story. NIST officially got rid of the long-suspected but never proven bad random number generator standard. This is the one that RSA is accused of taking $10 million to turn into the default, and many people suspect that it has a backdoor, but demonstrating the backdoor has proven quite difficult. And there's action in Rand Paul's lawsuit over the 215 program. He and the Justice Department are sparring over whether that lawsuit can go forward while an interim appeal is pending. Nothing determined yet. So the most important and most interesting story about NSA came from the release by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence of yet another set of briefs and a judicial decision by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. An undisclosed carrier, but according to the Washington Post, that's Verizon, has gone to the court and said, you know, we read Judge Leon's decision saying, I think this whole program is unconstitutional. Could you reassure us that you still believe that this program is constitutional in light of Judge Leon's opinion? And the court and the I think the judge was Rosemary Collier wrote an opinion that really, if it was a prize fight, would have been stopped after the 10th round. She eviscerates Judge Leon's opinion, which was highly imaginative and colorful in its language. That's the opinion that said this, I'm not going to follow a Supreme Court precedent, Smith against Maryland case, because that was written in 1979, and we use our phones for much more. For example, we hold them up at rock concerts instead of lighters, and so obviously I shouldn't have to follow a 1979 Supreme Court case. Collier takes apart most of his justifications for not following Smith, but I thought the most brutal blow was in a little parenthetical where she quotes him saying that material that was being held by in the Smith against Maryland case was held for a few weeks or maybe months, but here he says this involves the creation and maintenance of a historical database involving 5 years underlined worth of data that might go on for as long as America is combating terrorism, which realistically could be forever! And Collier quotes that and then says, in parentheses, id italics and exclamation point in original. which I thought kind of the italics was necessary. The exclamation point was piling on. It was a way of saying, you know, exclamation points don't actually make your opinion more persuasive, Judge Leon. I've written briefly on this to suggest that this may be a lesson to other judges when they write opinions, and to ask the crucial question, was Judge Leon's caps lock key actually broken? Otherwise, I think we would have seen those as well. That's the news. It means that Leon's opinion is the only opinion so far issued by a judge finding the program unconstitutional. We'll see how far this goes now that there are a couple of appeals pending. The top story outside of NSA is probably the FCC's action, or maybe the campaign to turn the FCC's action into a story. The blogs and some of the newspapers were abuzz with claims, Stephanie, that FCC had decided it was going to gut net neutrality and was going to do it by Friday. We haven't actually seen it, seen anything. What is spurring all of this, and how much substance is there?
Right, Stu, and we won't actually see the text of an item until the commissioners, the five FCC commissioners, vote on it on May 15th, the date of their next open meeting. What generated the firestorm this last week was the announcement that the item was actually going to be circulated from the chairman, from Chairman Wheeler's office to the other commissioners. And it's not a surprise necessarily, although I think a lot of people thought he might do a little bit more. He is following what we know was in the proposed new net neutrality rules that are going to be put out for comment following the May 15th open meeting.
Mm-hmm.
So it's far from over. And a lot of the hoopla that we're hearing now is really a lot of companies and interests trying to push the item before it's even published, trying to get it revised, perhaps. And
I had a question that said, well, this is going to mean a fast lane on the internet, and the fast lines are going to consume the bandwidth, and people have to pay to get to their customers. Wasn't that sort of baked in once we saw the decision in the D.C. Circuit?
Well, it was baked in if you refuse to go to a Title II regime, which there's people in violent agreement that the FCC could do absent Congress.
Title II
is common carrier regulation,
okay.
Exactly. Which, you know, absent, you know, further lawmaking by Congress, you know, the FCC could do, and is actually, the courts are practically begging the FCC to do so they won't keep getting these stretched Title I authority challenges. But politically, that's very difficult for the commission to do at this point. The fast lanes were actually always in the FCC's open internet rules because the FCC's 2010 open internet order allowed specialized services.
If the internet is going to be destroyed by the FCC, it was destroyed in 2010?
Arguably so, because they said they would closely watch specialized services to see if they kind of encroached upon the open internet.
Which presumably they're going to do under this new rule too.
Exactly. But also not only the specialized services, but you could actually, you know, pay to play or pay for prioritization over the quote open internet portion of the pipe into people's homes as well. Subject to commercially reasonable standards. But as some people have pointed out, commercially reasonable standards in the data roaming context, for instance, do include, you know, you're going to compete with my stuff.
Right.
So we'll see. Some people did propose that they include rules for affiliated providers that were more stringent from what we hear that won't be in the item. So there were some perhaps more aggressive alternatives that the FCC could have taken that it does not look like they are taking.
Right. That looks like small ball compared to the
headlines. Well, when you consider that after Comcast Time Warner,
right,
if the merger is allowed to go forward, they'll have almost 50% of true broadband internet, high-speed internet connections in the house for households in the United States, and they are an affiliated provider. If there were more stringent requirements for that, you know, they would qualify. So I don't know if it's toothless.
Right.
It sounds as though
they will have enough authority to come down on people who end up in the newspapers and are heavily criticized for doing something aggressive, like really degrading the base level of service to their customers while extracting heavy rents from big websites.
Interesting that you mentioned base level, because one of the things that they say is in the item is some kind of minimum throughput requirement, some kind of minimum service that they have to meet, but we'll see how.
Jason has made a career on this podcast of pointing out that the FTC basically shoots victims and picks on people who end up in the newspaper, exercising massive amounts of discretion. Sounds like the FCC likes that model.
We'll see. Historically, things that are controlled by, you know, bringing a dispute before the commission never go anywhere. For this kind of ad hoc dispute resolution kind of approach to open internet to have any teeth, people will at least demand some very discreet and aggressive timelines for resolution of disputes to make the FCC make a decision, because in the past, they really have dragged their feet on making decisions on certain things. So that would be a big piece of what comes out on May 15th.
Okay. Speaking of Jason, there was a long story, Jason, in the New York Times, the point of which was a little unclear. We were supposed to be shocked that the FBI had taken a member of Anonymous, whom they'd actually arrested, and turned him and gotten him to implicate some of his conspirators in Anonymous, and had pointed the conspirators at the websites and systems of foreign governments, if I understand it. I'm trying to figure out what the bad news is in that, but maybe you are better at interpreting the Times than I.
No, I don't think I am. So I was involved in the investigation that led to this hacker's arrest in 2011 and some of the arrests that followed, so I need to stay away from
the details.
Stuff related to the investigation. As a general matter, I don't know if the New York Times story is accurate or not. If it is, I'm not sure why people would be alarmed that a valuable asset developed by law enforcement would be used to develop national security information as well. The concern, if there is any, should really be the other way around. You know, if prosecutors were using national security authorities to develop criminal evidence because they couldn't meet criminal standards, if they were in fact directing the activities of the national security folks, that might be cause for concern. But I'm not suggesting we go back to the wall. But in the absence of a situation where prosecutors on the criminal side are using lower national security standards as an end run around the Fourth Amendment, I'm not sure what the concern is here. In fact, I think it's entirely appropriate that, I mean, this guy was a unique asset identified at the time as a unique hacker, someone with street cred that was unparalleled in the world hacker community, and someone who could be deployed in a number of creative ways. And if in fact he's been deployed in the way the Times suggested, I think it's something that should be applauded, not criticized.
I remember we're of course familiar with the ties between cyber criminals and the state in places like Russia and China. I remember a case where we worked very hard to catch a guy who turned out to be an Israeli teenager who was engaged in hacking some of our sites, and we got the Israelis to arrest him, and then they gave him a suspended sentence if he would join their elite cyber unit in the Israeli Defense Forces. So everybody has been doing this, I think.
There's potentially a lot less to this story than it suggests, because this is really an article that wasn't ready to be published, because it's not even clear that the government was directing its informant to direct another hacker to do anything. This is all these insinuations are coming from a leaked sentencing memorandum that's, you know, it's very unclear what's going on. The other thing here is that the hacker was attacking websites. It's hard to understand what sensitive foreign government information is going to be available on a government website, such as the website of the Ministry of Electricity in Iraq or a Polish embassy. So, you know, there's just, potentially there's something interesting here, but potentially this is just making a mountain out of a molehill.
It starts to feel like it might have been a leak from the defense side, since they would have seen the sentencing memo, and this is a way of getting a story out.
But the reporter is not giving a lot of information from the memo, and it doesn't seem like he's interviewed anybody that might know what's actually going on. If the government has been directing the hacker to attack websites, there would be an interesting agency question of whether the hacker is now the agent of the government, and is potentially governed by Fourth Amendment requirements. But then that raises another issue about what in particular were the targets that were attacked, because a foreign government overseas doesn't have any Fourth Amendment rights.
Right, and they're not going to be defendants, so they won't be arguing about whether the Fourth Amendment was violated.
Even if they were defendants.
You're right.
Right.
We're going to talk a little bit about whether the Fourth Amendment applies abroad later in the program.
You know, I think this story, Mike's right. I had the same reaction he did when it first came out, which was that there were a lot of leaps involved that maybe could have been filled in with some more reporting. But I think it becomes a more interesting story and an embarrassing one for the government if it turns out the hacker was not being directed by the government.
Oh, yes.
He was, you know, when he became a sign-up cooperator, the government made representations about the extent to which it would be in a position to monitor all of his online activities. And if this was going on under the nose of law enforcement but without their permission, it creates a whole other range of problems.
I think the Secret Service had that problem with a guy down in Florida.
They did.
Yeah.
Hopefully this is not a repeat of that.
Well, I wonder also if we're starting to see that for the establishment press, they hear footsteps on these national security stories that they didn't used to hear, and they're rushing. You know, the Bloomberg story about Heartbleed was also rushed into print before they got a final word from the government. And I think that may be a permanent change as a result of what Greenwald has introduced into the press dynamic. Michael, what about this decision under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act in Louisiana? It sounds as though you can become liable for hacking a website after the fact, not a website, a network after the fact, if you get information you're entitled to and then you misuse it?
Yeah, this is an issue that has split the courts for a number of years now. And it boils down to basically if an employee at a company has legitimate authorized access to the company network and uses that access to download information that he then takes with him when he quits or is fired and gives to his new employer, and uses to its advantage, is that a violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which prevents taking of information without authorization or in excess of authorization? The Fifth and the Seventh Circuits have said that is a violation of the CFAA for various reasons. Either you violated the policy and thereby lost your authorization to access the data and the network, or you've lost your power to be an agent of your computer when you act as of your employer when you act disloyally. The Fourth and the Ninth Circuits have said if you had legitimate authorized access at the time you took the information, it doesn't matter what you do later. You know, the employer has to go after the person for fraud, but there's no CFAA violation. The recent Louisiana case just followed the reasoning of the Fifth and the Seventh Circuits and said that the employee, when he took the information, violated a very broad confidentiality agreement, and therefore his access was not authorized when he did it for the purpose of taking information that he was later going to disclose. So, I think this is an issue that's not going to be resolved by the circuits because there's a deep divergence now. And so unless the Supreme Court jumps into this or Congress amends the statute, I think we're going to have the circuits and district courts interpreting it differently.
So if you're an employer, you should probably have a standard clause in your termination letter that says, by the way, if you printed off anything from a network and took it home, you're not authorized to keep it. You have to bring it back. And if you don't bring it back, you are hereby retroactively a felon under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act.
Well, I don't think that sort of termination agreement would necessarily help, and that there are a lot of termination agreements that have similar prohibitions. But what I have advised companies is that they write their employee manuals very carefully, so that they state specifically that when an employee accesses the network for an illegitimate purpose, that access is not authorized at the time the access takes place. And I think you might see courts beginning to go the way of this Louisiana federal district court in Louisiana, if company policies are written more clearly. And that may be, you know, that when companies catch on to this, that may drive the judicial trend towards the direction of this decision.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, the Supreme Court is taking one of these techno-libertarian questions, and this week it's going to be argued, probably the last week of argument in the term, the question of when you need a warrant to look at a cell phone that you've acquired from somebody upon his arrest. Usually when you arrest somebody, you go through everything he's got on him and his car too, if you've seized his car. But the argument seems to be that, it's a sort of a Judge Leon argument, but there's everything in there, plus I use it at rock concerts. Jason, have you looked at this case closely?
Yeah, so this is an argument in two cases that reached opposite conclusions about whether law enforcement can search a cell phone seized from an arrested person without a warrant under the search incident arrest doctrine. One of them, which went the defendant's way, is a First Circuit case called U.S. versus Worry, in which the court throughout a drug dealer's conviction on the grounds that the police had searched the contents of his flip phone incident to arrest without a warrant and then used that information to learn the address of his physical residence, got a warrant for that, and then seized drugs and other evidence that was used to convict him. And they argued that all of that was the fruit of a poisonous search of his flip phone. There's a California state case called Riley versus California where the court went the other way and endorsed a warrantless search of a gang member's smartphone incident to arrest. So as you alluded to, the doctrine of search incident to arrest has been around for, you know, well over 100 years, and it says in substance that because a person has a reduced privacy interest in their person and belongings that they're carrying when they're arrested, officers can seize and search without a warrant anything on their person, including stuff that's in closed containers. It could be papers, could be physical objects, could be address books, diaries. If you have a briefcase, they could search the papers and other effects in your briefcase. And the courts have said that it's not just to protect officer safety or to prevent the destruction of evidence, although those are benefits of the doctrine, but it's to gather evidence of a crime. And so the defendant in the Worry case and in the Riley case and just about every civil libertarian organization known to man or that has an acronym is joining the challenge to the doctrine in this context. And they're arguing that cell phones are unique, the sort of the Judge Leon argument, that they are unique repository of a vast amount of personal information, and that means they present unique privacy intrusions and they merit different treatment under the law. And they're arguing that the doctrine as applied to cell phones gives the police or federal agents free rein to search the phones and collect all kinds of private information, whether or not it's in any way related to the crime under investigation. And they argue that there's no reason to be worried about destruction of evidence because there are technologies that can be deployed to preserve and store the phones pending issuance of warrants.
This is the first, surely the first case that features a long and bitter factual argument over Faraday bags.
That's probably right. Now the government, as you would expect, goes the other way. The government says that the fear that law enforcement is going to use the authority to search cell phones to needlessly invade the privacy of their arrestees, imaginary and unsubstantiated, they argue that notwithstanding the availability of Faraday cages and other technology, that there is a significant risk that the phones will automatically lock, their passwords will kick in, the contents will be encrypted, or that they can be wiped remotely. And the government makes the broader argument that since the doctrine is not about destruction of evidence, it's about the collection of evidence, that the court doesn't need to really resolve that issue to decide that the search incident arrest doctrine applies to cell phones just like any other container. But if it does, the government argues that there's great concern about destruction of evidence and that by itself should motivate the courts to preserve law enforcement's ability to capture that evidence. And what they argue fundamentally is that...
Is the kill switch dead?
Well, it's interesting. You know, a number of commentators have suggested that it's a little bit talking out of both sides of their mouth, that the government's arguing for a kill switch and then turning around and saying that the availability of technology to kill the phone makes it more likely that evidence will be destroyed. That technology, you know, at least for iPhones, has been around for a while. And even back when I first started as a prosecutor, the concern used to be, your last 10 calls list, went back when phones used to only store your last 10 or 15 received calls, that there'd be concern that if you received another call, it would push them off. And so even before there were kill switches or vast amounts of information on cell phones, this has always been a concern. But the government argues fundamentally that even though cell phones, with due respect to Judge Leon, contain more information about a person than other types of containers, they don't contain fundamentally different types of information than those that the government's always been able to search and send to arrest. And so they argue that it would put law enforcement at a huge disadvantage. I think the case has the potential to have even bigger impact than the Jones case, in terms of being a battleground for this question of whether the developments in technology fundamentally change the way we think about privacy.
Yeah, I have to say, watching the Supreme Court deal with these technologies has not been an edifying spectacle thus far, right? But I hope you'll come back next week and tell us how the argument went.
Sure.
I'm struck by the fact that last week they had an argument in the Aereo case, which is sort of at the edge of what we usually talk about, but because of the technology connection, it's probably worth talking about a bit. Aereo are the guys that have watched the success of technologies like Slingbox and the Supreme Court's decision that you have a right to make copies for time shifting purposes of broadcasts, and said, well, fine, why don't we help people time and place shift these broadcasts by selling them little tiny antennas, which we'll hold on to, and we'll ship them the programs wherever they want them. So we're really just doing what other companies have been allowed to do, and we won't have to pay what the cable companies are paying in terms of transmission fees. That case went up to argument, and it was remarkably confused, I'd say. It was pretty clear, I thought, that the government, that the court wasn't thrilled with Aereo's business model. It looked way too lawyerly and not business-like enough for them. And then they were struggling with how do we kill this business model without also killing the cloud, which does depend on people being able to store stuff, move stuff, on companies making it easier to do that. I'm very worried about this case.
I think you're right, Stuart. I think it's part of kind of the confusion in copyright law. I think the last 10 to 15 years with the advent of digital rights management and what is fair use and how much can digital rights management do away with fair use, and can we use technology? Can we both restrict consumers' fair use and at the same time but we can't use technology to go around, kind of like gerrymander around the restrictions in the law. At the same time, you know, it's very difficult to distinguish Aereo's offering on the basis of precedent as it currently exists, but I think it was very clear that the justices were disturbed by the business model, which there's no reason for them to have an individual micro antenna per customer.
Except to get around the transmission.
Right. But it's worthwhile to note that you use the word transmit. I think Aereo would say that the customer
pulls it.
Exactly. And the one of the key questions here is volition. Who's doing the action? Who's the actor? And is it the customer or is it
what a
Aereo?
Dumb thing for this to turn out.
Well, you know, I think it matters a lot in copyright law, who's doing what and when. And the basis of the Sony precedent, you know, which, you know, your right to time shift, you're recording on your home VHS back in the 1980s, and the Cablevision decision, which really is what Aereo is, you know, structuring its business on, which, you know, said, you know, Cablevision can have a remote DVR for each of its customers, and so long as they're directing the recording and they're directing the playback, it doesn't matter where the DVR sat, if it sat in Cablevision's home offices or not. So it'll be interesting to see where it comes out. I think it'll be even more interesting to see what follows, because it's surely not going to satisfy everyone.
So, Michael, you were a Supreme Court clerk, if I remember right, and I wanted to try out a theory on you, which is that this case, where the court is completely uncertain about the direction it wants to go, is argued and assigned probably just before May begins. Whoever gets that assignment has got to produce a complete opinion for the majority, hopefully from their point of view, in about 4 weeks. So it can be circulated so they can get out of there by the end of June, because the people writing the dissent need a few weeks to review the opinion and write a dissent. My experience is those were the worst opinions that the court wrote. They're full of dubious statements and in some cases outright errors, because the law clerks don't have time to do the research and they are not really checked by the dissent, which arrives too late for anybody to do anything about it.
Yeah, it's, you know, the assignment would already have been made at the conference that followed on the Friday of following the argument. So somebody's already got the assignment.
And it's almost made up.
And there's, you know, there's likely to be multiple opinions in this case. So I think you're exactly right. And, you know, they still have to spend a lot of time figuring out whether they're going to grant certiorari in a petition that I've got before them that has been relisted now at three different conferences.
So they're really worried about you. Yeah,
well,
I can see how.
I don't care about the Ariel case. I want them to grant my case.
Do you want to lobby them right here? Or do you want, in case they're listening?
Well, it does involve technology. It involves, the use of a taser on a person who was handcuffed and on the ground, and the police tased him at least 8 times while he was on the ground because he wouldn't get up. No safety or flight risk. And the Fifth Circuit found no problem with that. Really unbelievable. But the court, you know, there is an interesting thing going on recently that the court seems to be relisting a lot of cases before it grants. But anyway, that's a little aside that matters a lot to me. But what's interesting about the Ariel case, you know, there's been a lot of talk in the media, and I think Justice Breyer raised this at oral argument about worries about the potential effect on the cloud. No one has explained what that potential effect is exactly, and I think there's a bit of exaggeration there. You know, I wouldn't be terribly surprised if the court didn't decide this case right now and put it off because...
That would be smart, actually, so they could actually think it through a little.
And think about the implications, because at least the oral arguments seem to indicate a lack of understanding about what the ramifications of a decision either way would be. And that's not to fault the justices. You know, I think that the amici and the parties maybe didn't address this point to the justices' satisfaction. So that's unlikely that they'd kick it till next year or have it re-argued, but it's always a possibility. And they have dismissed cases as improvidently granted recently, where they took a case, heard oral argument, had briefing, and then decided not to decide. So
yeah,
that's always a possibility.
I don't think they're going to do that here because there was a split in the circuits. But I do think your other point, which is was right, that not only do they sometimes make mistakes, they also just split. Everybody just writes their own opinion because there's no time to get behind a single relatively narrow opinion. And that's a way of not making law. It's almost an alternative to dismissing as improvidently granted.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I don't want to miss this week in Magistrate Facciola, who's getting heavy coverage for his approach to warrants. We've talked about it before. We suggested it's hard to appeal these cases, but the Justice Department actually found a way to do that. How did they do it?
Yeah, it's interesting. Facciola had a very nice article about him and the other magistrates involved in the so-called Magistrates Revolt. In which they've been denying search warrant applications or imposing search protocols on the FBI and prosecutors. And this is actually a well-written article that went through a lot of the cases and really clearly explained the issues at hand. And it does seem that DOJ has managed to find ways of appealing adverse magistrate decisions to federal district courts, citing either the district court's original jurisdiction under the Stored Communications Act under 18 U.S.C. 2703, or their jurisdiction to hear appeals, as the government put it, under Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 58 and 28 U.S.C. 636. And it's interesting. It's clear that these are kind of tentative assertions by the government because those sources aren't entirely clear on whether there is actually the right to appeal. And some of them at least seem to make district court's authority to hear an appeal or review a magistrate decision as discretionary. And I think that brings up the point that Jason has made in the past, that a lot of district judges just say, I'm not going to hear an appeal. I'm not going to review a magistrate's decision. You know, that he did his role and let him do it. There's also at least one court of appeals, the Third Circuit, which 4 years ago actually heard an appeal that started with a magistrate, went up to the district judge who agreed with the magistrate, and then it went to the Third Circuit, and the Third Circuit held, it reversed the magistrate and said that the government could get cell site location data without getting a warrant. They could get a so-called 2703D order, which is based on a lower standard. So there are ways to appeal, but it seems like it's a mixed bag about whether district courts will give the government a second bite at the apple.
It does seem to me as though the more the magistrates pat themselves on the back for all the great innovative, creative stuff they're doing that may not be consistent with the requirements of law, the more likely district courts and especially courts of appeals are going to say, what do you mean we can't hear that that question? That's too important just to leave to a batch of magistrates whose opinions can't be aligned.
I think that's right. Certainly raising visibility about the issues, and that may make district courts either be more willing to review magistrate decisions or change internal rules of the courts and say, we're going to hear these cases now directly. That means more work for them, but...
Yeah.
But I was surprised to learn from the article that the magistrates who have written opinions as part of this magistrates revolution have T-shirts.
Yeah,
that's right. If you write an opinion, regardless of which way you come out, you get a free T-shirt.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder if they'll send those to district courts who decide to review them. Okay. One last topic before we get to our interviews. In cybersecurity, the FTC is still talking about cybersecurity regulation. Jason, is that a surprise?
No.
Okay.
Not at all.
And
especially because they're saying they want more power.
Exactly. Probably more interesting is the president has an executive order in place of legislation that says we're going to encourage particularly critical infrastructure companies to adopt our cybersecurity framework, and we're going to come up with mechanisms for incentivizing them, which could be good or could be bad consequences. And of course, to do that, you have to know who's in and who's out of the critical infrastructure. So there's a process for a kind of skull and bones process for designating people and tapping them on the shoulder, but not revealing the identities of the companies. That has happened now, Stephen. Is that right?
That's right. So the Department of Homeland Security announced that it had finished the tapping folks on the shoulder process. They made that announcement just about 2 weeks ago on April 17. The department transmitted the list of critical cyber infrastructure back in July of last year, but then it took them a while to finish the tapping process. So now they've announced that they're complete, and everybody that has been placed on the list, the owners and or operators of that critical infrastructure, now know it.
So if you're out jogging listening to this program and you haven't had the tap, you're off the hook.
That's right. You are not on the list if you haven't been alerted up to this point, but that list will be reviewed and updated annually, so you're not off the hook for good. Things can still happen. And the notice that the department issued on April 17th said that in addition to the fact that they're going to update this this list annually, there is a process for appealing, in effect, for requesting reconsideration. It's discretionary by the Department of Homeland Security. It's really NPPD, the National Protection and Programs Directorate within DHS, that's in charge of this process. And they will, if they get a request before May 15, they will entertain a request for reconsideration. So if you are on that list and think that you should not be, or less likely if you are not on the list but want to be on the list, You can send the department a note by email and make the request, and you can also request a meeting, which is generally we've found helpful to establish a rapport with the department.
So it's just barely enough to meet the requirement of due process, is my guess.
That may be right.
Okay, well, thank you, and I hope you'll stick around because we're going to be talking CFIUS. And let me switch to our interview now, because we have two, for the first time, two participants in our interview, and if you can, let me introduce them both. Ilana Breutman is from the Defense Department. She's responsible, really, for more than CFIUS. She worries about the health of the defense industry, making investments in companies where necessary to preserve capabilities, and reviewing mergers and acquisitions, both for antitrust and CFIUS considerations. Ilana, welcome. And Sean Cooley of the Department of Homeland Security manages directly the department's participation in CFIUS and in the informal interagency working group known as Team Telecom, which plays a role similar to CFIUS in reviewing FCC license applications for national security, law enforcement, and public interest implications. Sean, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Let me start out by talking a little bit about how we got here. One of the big challenges for U.S. security in the 21st century is the globalization of IT. It's an opportunity, as Edward Snowden has disclosed, it is a problem because everything that Snowden revealed the National Security Agency could do could be done to us if particular technologies or companies are susceptible to foreign influence. DoD in particular has made a move in the last 20 years to become much more dependent on commercial technology because the commercial technology was just moving faster than anything the government could acquire on its own. And that means that the entire infrastructure that we rely on for our commercial transactions is also an infrastructure that has strong security implications for DoD. So the industry's changed a lot, but what hasn't changed really much is the legal tools that we have available to deal with that. So why don't I just ask each of you to lean into the mics and give us a quick overview of the tools that you have for dealing with these sorts of issues in technology.
Sure, I guess I'll start. You're right, the industry has changed a great deal. A stat that we often talk about is that 30 years ago, about 70% of the products that we bought originated with DoD's contracts or investments in R&D. Today it's flipped, and 70% did not originate with us. Moreover, when we talk about the DIB, the Defense Industrial Base, you have to look at all of their suppliers, and it may be that we're buying one or two, three layers down from defense companies, but beyond that, they're buying from a much more diversified base, which could be global, which could be commercial. So it's much more challenging. Just getting our hands or our arms around what it is that we're purchasing is much more complicated than it used to be. So we do have some of the rules rules and best practices that we've imposed, certainly around cybersecurity. We've had the cybersecurity pilots with the DIB itself around classified information, and we're feeling, you know, more secure than at least with other, on other fronts, that the classified information is pretty well protected. We've had a lot of concern, though, that there's still a lot of sensitive information out there that's not classified, and how do we get our arms around the cybersecurity of that system? And fairly recently, we put out a DFAR, a Defense Federal Acquisition Rule, and it goes to securing certain types of unclassified information. We couldn't make it too broad, or it would just be unwieldy. But it does require companies to use some best practices as outlined in the NIST or by NIST processes. So hopefully that helps us get around some of the...
Is that going to end up being thought of in terms of the NIST cybersecurity framework? It wasn't... You came out with the DFAR before the cybersecurity framework was done. Are you going to end up sort of trying to merge the requirements with the cybersecurity framework?
So I think that we're trying to make sure that companies don't have to follow too many different rules. So we are trying to leverage what else is being done in the government, and obviously NIST comes up with a standard, so that makes sense. And we have, of course, we have the CFIUS rules with respect to foreign acquisitions, but really it goes so as you well know, it goes so far beyond foreign acquisition. I mean, there's so many gaps in security just with U.S. Products and entities. So it's a continuously challenging issue for us.
Do you also have responsibility for Team Telecom, or is that something else?
It's part of my the CFIUS group that reports to me.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. And Sean, you run the Department of Homeland Security's CFIUS organization, and I should say at this point, CFIUS, the committee itself, is chaired by the Treasury Department. Treasury is an overseer and is pretty strict about saying, if you want to deal with CFIUS, you deal with us, especially once a filing's been made. And if you are going to make CFIUS policy, you'll make it through the committee, not individually. So we're not asking you to talk about CFIUS. We're asking you as a whole, but about the department's approach to CFIUS. So how do you handle CFIUS and, I assume, Team Telecom issues inside the department?
So just like any other member to the committee, we have our established process or protocols where we receive cases, conduct due diligence on the cases, and ultimately make risk assessments and recommendations to senior leadership that have to sign off on a case, propose mitigation, or propose recommendations for the committee to send it to the president for a potential block.
So a lot of people who give advice in this area always wonder, because the rules, or at least the concerns, change, and they often change because of classified information that can't be disclosed. They wonder, well, what deals do I have to take to CFIUS, or would I be wise to take to CFIUS? And obviously that depends in part on what each department thinks is a particularly sensitive area. Any guidance on that from the department's point of view?
So from DHS's perspective, I think we're unique among CFIUS members given our broad areas of responsibility, from border and port security to immigration to export control enforcement to IT cybersecurity. So I think a general rule of thumb is when in doubt, consider the implications.
Yeah, well, that's certainly that. Many companies have learned that to their chagrin, because speaking of skull and bones, the CFIUS certainly has a process for reaching out and touching people and saying, "Excuse me, but you weren't planning on closing that deal before you talked to us, were you?" And you know, if the relationship starts that way, it never really ends very well. Ilana, what are the concerns from your point of view that might lead you to say you'd be surprised, but you ought to file for CFIUS on this?
I mean, they're much like DHS's and every other agency, in that there's a pretty broad definition of what entails a CFIUS covered transaction. Ultimately, Treasury is the chair of that table, and well, it's Treasury General Counsel will have the final say on that, but it's probably better to go ahead and file and rather than not.
Yeah, yeah. If you've got doubts, it certainly seems in this climate that the right thing to do is to file, because in 30 days you'll have an answer if you shouldn't have filed.
Or shorter if it's not covered.
Okay, well, that's true, but not covered is a. That's a fraught decision. It's easier just to clear the transaction than to decide whether it's not covered. At least then that's my experience. So I did want to ask, because this is new since my time dealing with CFIUS, and my sense is it's really a DOD concern, which is that increasingly we're seeing companies who need to file or need to go through the mitigation process because they're too close to some military installation of one sort or another. Is there any guidance you can give to people on when they're likely to run into those sorts of problems?
It's, as with every case, everything is so fact-specific, but when we look at the risk to
to the national security interest that the DoD protects. Clearly, our installations and the sensitive training that we do and sensitive R&D activities are a huge part of it. So location, just like actual purchase of assets, are both at stake for us.
Right. So, I mean, it may be, not that we would necessarily know, but obviously being close to a research facility, especially one that has to proceed in the open air, or something where pretty sophisticated weapons usage and training is going on. Those are things that are more likely to trigger these, I was going to call them propinquity concerns, but Sean was mocking me before we started, these proximity concerns.
As a country, as a government, for all that that's been said, we're a pretty open government, certainly as compared to others, where there are all kinds of investment restrictions. And so I think any good lawyer or M&A banker thinking about a transaction can take a look at lots of open source information, understand where there might be DoD equities, and even if some of this stuff that's happening is so secret that it won't be in the open, or ought not to be, let's hope it's not in the open, there's a pretty good guess that, hey, we should do more due diligence, or at least file to find out if there's going to be a problem.
Right.
From CFIUS's perspective, they've suggested that part of the due diligence, if you really don't know, is to file with CFIUS, and they will tell you whether there's a proximity problem or not.
Yeah.
I wonder, a decade ago, the CFIUS process was much looser, and the mechanisms for pulling these agencies, the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Defense, are sprawling agencies, and I recall it being a challenge when we were in government to ensure that all of the components of these agencies had provided input in a timely way. I wonder if you could comment on that, how that process works. How do you make sure that these far-flung pieces of your departments have all provided comments on these cases?
Or at least have gotten a notice so that if they object later, you can tell them they missed their chance.
Right, so that's still a very challenging issue for the department, especially Homeland Security, as we're still going through some growing pains. But through the passage of time and experience, we get better at it. The components get better at understanding through our continual education process about why we're asking the questions that we are, and establishing open lines of communication so that we can not only request responses in a timely manner, but then exchange ideas, because it's not always the first response is the ultimate best response to the questions that we're trying to do in order for us to complete our risk assessments.
And which agency, which
I want to ask Alana the same question, because DoD is at least as diverse as
We're pretty diverse. We're pretty diverse. So we definitely have continuing education because, people also cycle in and out of places, and you get different types of cases. We sort of have seen trends in certain kinds of cases that will entail the expertise of certain people that may not have been involved in the past, so you need to educate people. But we have a point of contact in every service, in every major agency. One thing that's really helpful to us at DoD is there are two sort of sister agencies that are very strong partners of ours. One is DSS, the Defense Security Service, because they do foci mitigation. They have really knowledgeable people with respect to how mitigation might work.
These are the folks who decide already under an existing set of rules whether foreign ownership, control, or influence means that a defense contractor can't be a contractor anymore, and how to mitigate that problem.
Exactly, and there are such analogous issues there that it's not as such a large group of people, but they're very helpful. And then DITSA, which is the DoD agency that's part of the whole export control regime, is very important to us too, because they have technology experts, they have and they're involved in the whole export control dialogue in the interagency.
So they know who the foreign suppliers are. They know how much is left of the U.S. industry in particular cases.
There are all kinds of ways. And then, when it comes, given that this is a cyber law series, obviously we're partnered with CIO pretty heavily, CIO is self-explanatory, for a lot of our, whenever there's a technology case, certainly the first on our list to be a close partner.
So you've mentioned CIO, DITSA, DSS as primary or as frequent participants in this process. Any others that
well,
come
every
up here?
Every service, you know, Navy, Air Force, Army, and sometimes Marines, but they often will speak through the Navy, has a particular POC, and then they're responsible for really asking different components of those services because there are lots of different issues, different components. And then depending on the case, it could be a particular agency that has an interest in that. You know, it could be a lab, a research lab that's doing research in a particular component. It could be the Missile Defense Agency if there were a missile component. It just depends. And this is really true for DHS as well, it's just that we're a bigger enterprise. Not only are we diversified in terms of scope of agencies, but also in terms of geography and people not being co-located ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
We're still a human enterprise.
Are you in the Pentagon?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you can reach somebody in the Pentagon, although not everybody that you need to talk to is there. Yeah.
Sean, how about for cyber cases in DHS? What are the components of DHS that typically?
So typically, it's MPPD, which you mentioned earlier, and CIO as well. Those stand out as unique component participants in that they comment across the broad spectrum of IT and cyber equities that we have, as opposed to most other components that we have are really focused on addressing their specific equities, whether it's through contracting or application. We've had an increased role and participation within MPPD and CIO over the last 10 years.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that has struck me is just how much data is being collected by social media, which have turned out mostly to big U.S. companies, but some of the biggest social media companies, some that are almost as big as Facebook, certainly hundreds and hundreds of millions of users, are outside the U.S. China, Russia both have big social media companies. Have you had any social media cases that raised concerns, or is that something that will happen in the future if there are purchases there?
And well, we can't comment on cases that we've actually reviewed or even acknowledge which cases have been reviewed, but suffice it to say that we're aware of that trend and monitoring it closely.
Yeah. So just because you decide you're interested in something, a particular industry, a particular company, a particular location, and you want them to file and you want to engage them, does that mean the transaction is going to be rejected?
Because of a stated interest?
Because you've got a national security concern or homeland security concern?
No, quite the contrary. I mean, like the decision to and the authority to block a transaction, it resides only in the president, can't be delegated down to the committee. So the committee doesn't even have the authority. At most, the committee has the authority to make a recommendation that the president consider exercising his authority to block a transaction. And it's exceedingly rare. I mean, in the history of the body, it's only happened twice, most recently 2 years ago.
So what do you do when you've got national security concerns, but you would prefer not to recommend a veto? How does that get handled?
So when the committee or a member has an unresolved national security concern, member's obligation to conduct a risk assessment and determine if there's any mitigative options available to resolve that risk short of making a recommendation for a prohibition.
We keep hearing about the number of U.S. companies, and I'm quite sure other companies that have been compromised by foreign nationals engaged in cyber espionage for commercial purposes or perhaps for nation-state reasons. When you're reviewing a transaction, how much of a role and what kind of a role does the possibility of network exploitation come into the calculus? Does that mean that an otherwise good candidate might be subjected to scrutiny because you know they've been compromised many times?
I mean, as our detection capabilities have increased, this is an increasing challenge for us, how to know when a company, whether or not it's an acquiring company or a target company, has been compromised, or at least the target of CNE attacks, and how that factors into a reasoned risk assessment. They both have significant potential implications.
I wanted to ask Alana about the various mechanisms to provide guidance to the private sector on cyber and other security matters. So we've talked about CFIUS and the DSS process, the Defense Security Service FOCI mitigation process. What are some of the other mechanisms for you to provide guidance to the private sector? Even in the CFIUS and FOCI mitigation, you can read the rules, but a lot of what you need to know, standing in the shoes of a private sector company, comes about through communication, formal or informal communication with the department. So what are some of the other fora in which you end up speaking to the private sector, having communication?
Sure. Thanks for that question, actually, because it's a great opening to invite people to always contact us. The Office of Manufacturing and Industrial Base Policy, my office, isn't just, you know, assign the jurisdictional responsibilities that Stuart outlined, but also we're a venue for industry to come in and talk about all kinds of issues that they might have with our rules or what have you. So, for example, we just put out a DFAR that I had mentioned about unclassified information. A colleague of mine within AT&L actually led that DFAR, but we work closely with her office and industry. So we'll work with the defense industry associations, but also with others. And I guess I'm always worried about seeming like I'm making some associations seem better than others. So this is not a plug, but AIA, NDIA are two obvious defense industry associations, but Tech America or the Chamber's Cyber Committee or others are also great ways to bring issues to us, as well as individual companies. So just an example of an emerging issue that I don't think industry has really grappled with yet, but we've started thinking about at a policy level, is the cybersecurity of the manufacturing shop floor. So we, in my office specifically, are sponsoring some institutes. These are the National Network of Manufacturing Institutes that the president has announced in a couple of states of the union. A couple of our institutes have to do with, one is with 3D manufacturing, one is the digital thread, which is manufacturing, really managing the process on the internet. Both are highly dependent on the tech sector and thus highly vulnerable. But people really aren't thinking about cybersecurity of, like, literally what happens when machines stop and you can't produce, you know, a part of that air wing. And we're starting to work with one of the industry associations to try to figure out the dimensions of that cyber risk, but also the cost to our enterprises and try to address that cyber risk. So, you know, just like in that scenario, we're an open door to try to understand how these security precautions might really drive costs for industry.
You know, the security of Windows is a little scary, though it's gotten much better. But it is years and miles ahead of the security in industrial control systems. And industrial control systems run power plants. I'm now free associating here. The most obvious example of a power plant whose security you would want to be sure about would be the nuclear power plants that run a lot of our most advanced naval vessels. And yet, when I have talked to experts in this field, they say once you've got a power plant up and running, or any really sophisticated industrial control system, the guys who are running it forget how it actually works, and they are afraid to change anything that's working because they aren't completely convinced they can bring it back up. And that means that for a lot of power plants, nobody's going to upgrade the security. They'd rather build a new plant than try to upgrade the security of their current industrial control system. That's obviously a big worry for DOD as well. What kind of initiatives do you have on industrial control system security that you can talk about?
Those are colleagues of mine in the department. It's not front and center my portfolio, but it's something that you know, we're working on cybersecurity measures in general pretty robustly because it's something that we're worried about. I mean, you all talked about the Snowden affair earlier. Clearly that we didn't need a wake-up call. It's not that we hadn't been concerned about things, but that
– Chelsea Manning might have done that.
Yeah, for different reasons. But we're also, you know, something else you mentioned, it's retaining the skills set in the U.S., not only for economic growth, but also to make sure that we actually know how to build the best of whatever it is we need and know how to maintain its security. And in the manufacturing arena broadly, we've been losing that steadily. And not just, you know, people think of the Chinese, but frankly, the Germans are great at it and haven't lost those skills. And so this Institute's initiative by the White House is a big initiative toward retaining and building more skill sets, especially in up-and-coming arenas.
I talked to a very talented kid at Brown University who was doing intrusion and security testing who said to me something that I just thought was clearly true, but I hadn't thought about it when we were talking about this. He said, you know, in this field, you're either self-taught or you aren't any good. And that raises the question of how we're training the people that we want to do this. I mean, the Germans at some point around age 16 say, kid, you're not going to college. You're going to learn a trade. That has led to a very talented, you could call them blue collar, but it's a very different set of skills.
It's a very sophisticated blue collar set of skills. It's trades. It's really very sophisticated trades. And there are certain kinds of welding skills or alloy making skills that are so important to the aerospace industry, which we were worried about losing, or we, in certain cases, we've lost. I think one really important model that Germany has is the training of young people. I mean, I think telling a 16-year-old where to go for school is not the American model.
Right.
I'm not advocating that, but getting better training throughout somebody's career is an important piece, and getting more kids excited about STEM. I mean, all the robotics initiatives, the MakerBots, all of that is in part to try to motivate young kids to continue before, you know, beyond third or fourth grade, and get to be our recruits, because we really do have a graying of our engineering sector, which we in the department are very, very concerned about.
Yeah, no, it is a worry. Any other advice that you would give to people who are not steeped in CFIUS and don't know what DIB stands for, Defense Industrial Base, where they might find themselves interacting with your offices?
Well, I don't want to speak for CFIUS, qua CFIUS, but just broadly, industry in general is changing so fast, especially in the technology arena, and it really behooves any company that wants to do business with us to come and be honest, but also really explain themselves, because there shouldn't be an assumption that we actually understand what some of the terminology will mean.
Right.
Not that we don't have plenty of smart people in the department, but you're not always talking to the people who are exactly on point, and having that dialogue, I think almost always will work in the company's favor.
So at the end of the, go ahead.
I was going to say, and echo what Alana just said, DHS has set up a collaborative system between public and private sector. We encourage that open dialogue and stand ready to engage and help people who may have questions about the FDI process.
Okay. Alana Breitman, Sean Quilley, thank you very much. At the end of these things, we usually give people an opportunity to say where they're going to be speaking, or to really plug anything else that they'd like to plug. So if you've got some upcoming speeches that you think people might want to come to, this is your opportunity.
Sorry, we'll just be going back to our windowless office.
You know, I have a plug for something, because I keep mentioning the institutes. There's a website called manufacturing.gov, manufacturing the way it's normally spelled, and that sets out the administration's initiative in these institutes. It's DOD and DOE mostly, but I think other agencies will come online, especially if Congress passes an appropriation we're hoping for. And that's a real opportunity for businesses, but it's also an opportunity for lawyers. There are all kinds of really interesting intellectual property issues, export control issues, that sort of thing in these institutes. I'd really encourage people to take a look.
Great. And Jason, Stephen, I've got some speaking engagements coming up.
Sure. On Wednesday, or the April 30th, depending on what day people are listening to this, I'll be in Boston at the SAN Security Leadership Summit doing my best imitation of you. And I have an article coming out this week, I think also on Wednesday, on an issue near and dear to Magistrate Judge Fajola's heart, which is the standards that should govern search warrants for computers and email accounts.
So, and I would, Stephen?
Until the midsummer, I'm staying put.
Okay, and I've been invited, ironically, to the Oslo Human Rights Forum by Garry Kasparov. And remarkably, he said, "No, you are not there as the pinata for the other groups." He actually wants to hear an explanation from a different point of view of how the Snowden affair might be counter to human rights. So I'll be doing that in about 2 weeks. So, Stephen, Stephanie, Michael, Jason, Alana, Sean, thank you very much for participating. This has been episode 17 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. We hope you'll join us next week for insights into the latest events in technology, security, privacy, and government.